A man is high on drugs, gets in his car, drives at very high speed down a road. His friends who are in the car with him urge him to slow down. He doesn't, hits a car, which is coming in the opposite direction, kills the driver, father of four. What do you do with him? A man with a violent past gets custody of his child one day a week, much to the concern of the mother who knows his past. On one occasion, while he has custody, the man kills his child. What do you do with that man? A man knocks on a door of a pensioner's house, telling him that he needs some work to be done on the roof. And the pensioner says, okay then. He does some work on the roof. And as he does so, comes in and says, gives him a price. The pensioner doesn't have the money, so he takes him to the bank and takes out £12,000 and gives it to him for the fictitious work that hasn't been done. What do you do with that man? One more. A young woman goes overseas with some radicalized school friends of hers and joins a terrorist camp organization. A few years later, after having lost two unsuccessful pregnancies, comes back, wants to come back to the country so that her current pregnancy is more successful. What do you do? What's your response to that woman? This is the nitty-gritty and the pain, the reality of justice. And I want to speak this morning about justice, following on from what we were talking about last Sunday. Why do I want to put this emphasis on justice? I will tell you. Because as I said last week, I am convinced that God is saying to his people, justice is not just something that should be important to your faith that you can't avoid. It should be one of the core principles that defines who you are as a follower of Jesus. It has to be crucial. But sometimes it's rather difficult. It's easy to say the word justice. It's not so easy to see how it works out. So last week, we looked at what we call distributive justice. Now you might look at me and say, I don't remember that. Well, actually, I didn't use the term distributive because it's a bit of a heavy term, but that's what it's referred as to as. Let me put it the way I did last week, sharing justice. Ensuring that justice is shared to everybody. Last week, we looked in detail through the lens of Deuteronomy 15 and Luke chapter 4, and we looked at how this principle of the Sabbath rest was taken by God and put into practice to spread through the whole of society for God's people, Israel. So we recognize that the principle of Sabbath is that you, every 7 days, stop. You have a break. You pick up the pieces again. You come right before God and prepare yourself for the week ahead. Applying that to the community of Israel gave us every 7 years what we called the year for cancelling debts. And each 7 years you give people the opportunity to wipe the slate clean, to remove those debts for everybody in society to avoid the pitfall that we call the poverty cycle that you can't ever get out of. God catered for that. And then, of course, there was the principle of the Sabbath year of Sabbath years. Every 49 years, on the 50th, you have a Jubilee year. Then things were really radical. And at that point, those who had land and had acquired it from other people all of it got sold back, given back rather, to the people that originally God had given that land to. It was an equaling of the playing field. And that, whilst that looked a little untidy and a little uncomfortable to think about last week, we covered it in some detail. If you weren't here last week, please listen. It's on the internet. Listen to it again and see how God dealt with it. What did distributive justice give us? A sharing of resources for everyone. Everybody was catered for, particularly the vulnerable, the weak. Equal access to opportunities. Nobody caught in this mess, this pit that we call the poverty gap, that folks in this country, most countries of the world, can find themselves in and cannot get out of. It just didn't happen. Well, today, the passage that we just read, which is quite a blunt passage, takes it a stage further. And it speaks about a judicial system. In other words, that's all good and well, but what happens when it goes wrong? What happens when there is sin? What happens when there are broken people? What do you do about it? And God established a principle for dealing with it. Instead of distributive justice, we might call this corrective justice. And I'm going to start with that this week briefly. So again, we find ourselves in Deuteronomy. And you all know now what Deuteronomy means, don't you? It means the second law. First law was given in Exodus. People came out of Egypt. And before they went on that journey with God to the promised land, he gave them the Ten Commandments and other laws. That was the first giving of the law. And after 40 years, they'd failed miserably to keep it. So Deuteronomy comes along, the second giving of the law. And we find in Deuteronomy some incredibly detailed legal requirements and the establishment of a judicial system. Kings and queens and rulers had always made judgments in countries. Just nothing new to have a judgment system. But what God did was he gave one that was fair, that was not biased, that was not based on status, but it was a fair system. And that's what that system was speaking of. And the passage that Sam read to us spoke about appointing judges who would speak without the bias. Do not pervert justice or show partiality. Do not accept a bribe, for a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and twists the words of the innocent. Follow justice and justice alone. And if I could give you a little catchphrase that you should take into the rest of your life as a Christian, it would be, follow justice and justice alone. And I believe God would smile on us if we could do that. And we... But that's what was set up here in these passages. If you were to read the next chapter, chapter 17, you'd see that there were also law courts established as well. God provided this judicial system, and it's detailed. God is taking wrongdoing seriously because he knows it messes up society. Do you think that wrongdoing messes up society? Of course it does. God knows that. It has such an impact, so he established a system. And it is detailed here in Deuteronomy more than in anywhere else in Scripture. Now that sounds good, doesn't it? Sorted the world's problems out. Anytime anyone sins, anytime anybody gets anything wrong, we've got the system, we've got the judges, we've got the courts, bang them up, sort them out, job done. Yep, we can all walk away and life's great. But if you know anything about the judicial system, you know it's not quite as black and white as that. It actually rarely works as simply. Those four cases I mentioned at the start, is it just as simple as they've done horrendous, heinous things? Lock them away and throw away the key. Is that good enough? Or would we just end up with a penal colony somewhere and gradually put more and more people into it, thinking we've resolved the problem? Would that resolve the problem, really? Remember, I said justice needs to be more than just merely important. It needs to define who we are. And there's something else that comes into God's idea of justice, which involves a compassion, which involves controversial things. And I did say last week I was going to be controversial today. Hang on, it's coming. But we need, I believe, to be different. There are two words in the Old Testament that speak about justice. Just bear with me. The first of those words is mishpat. Mishpat. I'm not asking you to remember this, but to remember there are two words. And mishpat has a meaning. It happens about 200, occurs around 200 times in the Old Testament. And it speaks about what could be summarized as that corrective justice, but giving justice to everybody fairly. So it maintains and it nurtures in a society good order. It seeks to cater for everybody. Nobody gets missed out. It protects the most vulnerable in society, and it brings equity to all, no matter their background, their status, their ethnicity. It just does not matter. That's mishpat. It is a justice, a concern, a passion for people, and that they have that fair system of judgment. You might say that was the what we would term as just desserts, punishing people according to just desserts, but trying to do it genuinely, fairly. We also call it due process in this country. In other words, you do this wrong, that is the penalty. Someone looks in a book and or knows how what it should be, and you perform the penalty that comes with it. That's what you receive. But does it work? Would you say it works in this country to have just a simple due process? Anyone think it works? No, of course it doesn't work. Partly because we're all human and we make mistakes and we struggle to give to not give the bias that God requires. And we certainly don't give due process in the way that Mishpat really intends, by giving everybody equality. We have 93,000 people in this country in prison as at the end of 2018. 93,000. I'm told there's capacity for 3,000 more. And our prison population is increasing at a rate of between 500 and 1,000 every year. Do the sums. We are in a state of absolute crisis in terms of filling our prisons. But even worse, 60% of people who go into prison tend to re-offend in exactly the same time period that they were in prison during anyway. It's a system that doesn't work on its own, as good as we try to get it. Some people have said we need to be so radical, we need to halve the population of our prisons. And I don't know the arguments, ins and outs for all of that, but that's the sort of desperate state we're in. Is that all that God had to say? I said there were two words. Mishpat was the first one, but there's a second, because there's something missing from the first alone. And the second word is zedekah, zedekah. And that brings something else into being, making right relationships, righteousness, living rightly with one another. And when you bring that in, right relationships, you then start to deal with some of the real issues that are going on in addition to just crime is committed, he's responsible, put him away for this long. It deals with more. Those two words, those two areas, aspects of justice that we find in the Old Testament tend to cover what serving justice truly and giving us a situation where wrong is righted, not just when someone gets their wrong, their just deserts, but when people are also brought into a place of correct relationship with other people. Hurts are healed. Society is mended. Relationships are reconciled. Much more goes on when we can bring both of those things to bear. So people have come to recognize that justice needs to be understood in terms of relationship. And that's what Mishpat and Zedekah together bring. The two words occur in the Old Testament again and again, right next to one another. We tend to translate them, the first one as justice, the second one as righteousness, living righteously. And the two occur again and again together. But it's all too easy for them to be pulled apart and to have one without the other. But we don't deal then with the problems that we have. When you do use them, you go from corrective justice to restorative justice. You actually begin to restore the thing that was damaged, not just pay for it. This is a biblical principle. And if you look at Deuteronomy, you start to see these things brought together. Now, this is a bit heavy, and I know it's quite heavy to recognize these things. You don't want to be talking about Hebrew words and different aspects of justice on a Sunday morning. But I want to encourage you to just push through and see how God uses this to help us deal with justice in a very different way in the society around us. One of the things we see in the passage that we've read is that God encourages us to bring community into this. So we have judges and law courts into play. We have maintaining not just now order, but also relationships in our society. And we have a whole community brought into the decision-making process. And so the restoring process, they're the ones brought to be judges, the law courts, and so on. And today, in the secular world, restorative justice is something which is developing more and more as people recognize we have to look at other ways of dealing with these problems. Did you hear in the news this week that the government is backtracking on its plans for privatizing the probation service? Did you hear about that? People said to them it's not going to work, and well, guess what, it didn't work. What I found really interesting is I listened to the news story this week and thought, thank you, Lord, for giving me something that speaks very much into what I want to say on Sunday, is I listened to a young man who I believe was an ex-offender. And he stood up and he said, you know, it doesn't work because we're not all the same. You can't say just leave prison and go and paint fences for a few hours a week and everything will be fine, because we are all individuals and the circumstances that we've all been through are different. And I find it really interesting listening to his perspective, because what he maybe didn't know he was talking about was he was talking about having relationships with people and dealing with what had actually gone on. And where's the victim in all of this? One of the things that tends to happen in law courts is that the main parties in any of these events is taken out of center stage and the professionals take over and the professionals make the decisions. So the offenders and the victim, they will give their accounts, but then they tend to be put to one side and the professionals take over. In restorative justice, that situation is changing. This man, Howard Zehr, is a probation, has a probation background. And some 50 years ago or so in the States, he looked at the way the law courts were operating and he said, this is just not working. Something is wrong. And he went back, because he was a Mennonite Christian, he went back to what he felt the Bible was saying, and he has been characteristic and formative in developing the restorative justice ideas. And he's saying it's not just about what's gone wrong? What was done and who's to blame? The question you should be asking is, who's been hurt? Who are the people involved? What are the relationships that are damaged? And there are some remarkable things now happening when people who are involved in crime on both sides volunteer to step up into what are called restorative justice conferences. And you have this remarkable thing where the person who's committed a crime sits in the same room as the person who's been violated in some way. And all the parties who might be involved, perhaps the community, perhaps the family of someone who suffered a loss, are all sitting in the same room. And I am told the tension is unbelievable at times, because these are things that you don't normally want to do. Who wants to volunteer to be in the room with a person that's killed someone you love? Who wants to be the person sitting opposite an individual whose husband you killed? But something remarkable happens. These are not just free-for-all sessions. Someone monitors what's going on. There are strict rules. If anyone gets aggressive in any way, it's shut down, and they come back when everyone's calmed down. This is the absolute opposite, by the way, of that certain program on television, Jeremy Kyle, that was shut down this week. It's the absolute opposite. I was listening to a Christian speaking about this just recently, and they were talking about their experiences of seeing a transformation in a prisoner who suddenly heard what they had done through the eyes of the person who'd suffered. And the person who suffered listening to the prisoner saying, well, I've got a drug habit and I have to support it, and actually feeling empathy and a sense of seeing things from their perspective, to the point where one particular case I'd love to tell you about, but I don't have time. At the end, there was an embrace. And they just spoke about, you know, if I see you in the street, I will talk to you. It's just remarkable when you bring relationships into it. Do you want to see where this has happened most publicly, most recently, that I can think of anyway? South Africa. Do you remember when the rather corrupt, biased, white South African government handed over power to the ANC? How did they deal with it? Well, Desmond Tutu got very much involved in what was called the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And they came and they worked through the pain, and people gave testimony, and they shared the hurts. They didn't brush it under the table. These are remarkable things. Restorative justice deals with three things that are not always comfortable to deal with. Number one, it includes radical participation. In other words, you get all the people who are affected and you bring them all together. You show respect. Wow, how our politicians could change if they engage with some of God's principles and brought people together. Radical participation. Secondly, they make morally serious judgments. Let me just clarify what that is, because it sounds a bit heavy. One of the criticisms for restorative justice is it's soft on crime. Sounds like if you're giving empathy to the person who's committed a crime, you're going to be soft on them. No. Morally serious judgments mean that when a crime has been committed, a person has to pay a price. It's the reason why in Scripture we see again and again people who God loved, who had a heart after God, still had to wear the consequences of the crimes they committed. Moses didn't enter the promised land because he'd sinned against God. Even though he was an amazing character, he still had to take that seriously. David committed adultery and sought to kill the husband of Bathsheba. He paid a heavy price for that. Read it. Solomon, his kingdom was divided. God takes crime seriously. Sin has to be atoned for. Restorative justice does not ignore it. But there's a third thing, reintegration. The whole point is restoring that community that has been broken. Three things that eventually are going to help us get to answer some of the questions we started at the beginning. Where do you see that happening in the New Testament? Where do you see Jesus speak about restorative justice? You see it in a parable. Can anyone tell me which parable is represented by this painting? Prodigal son. And my apologies, I touched on this when I spoke about restorative love on Easter. But for that reason, I'm only going to touch on it very briefly. This is a stunning representation of God's idea of putting things right. But this passage and the main parties that are recognized and are part of this whole parable, it all revolves around relationships that have been damaged, destroyed. This is what one commentator wrote. He said, "It is simply not possible to appreciate the significance of the actions in this parable of any of the characters without taking into account the ties of loyalty and the identity that bond them together as a household unit and a local community." So what was the thing that was so radical, so astonishing in this parable? It was partly the son did this remarkable thing in walking out on his dad and asking for his whole inheritance now. I want it today. And in that culture and that day, to ask for your inheritance was like saying to your father you wished him dead. It was serious. And if you think that's a bit strong, remember what the father said at the end. "My son was dead and now he's alive." He asked for his inheritance. He went away. He squandered it. He lost it. He ended up feeding pigs and being so hungry he needed to eat the food of the pigs until he realized, hang on, something's not right here. Even the servants at home are being well fed by my father. I should go back and apologize. And he goes back and the father runs to greet him. The thing that is shocking in the passage that you may remember from Easter Sunday morning is the father's response. Because the simple cultural and legal response that the father could, perhaps should, have given is to take that son into the public community and to say, "This guy is a reprobate. He's not doing what he should be doing. He's out of control." And he would have had to pay a very high price. It could have ended with him being stoned to death. If you're not sure, read Deuteronomy 21 and see what could have happened to him. The shock of this is that the father employed the principles of restorative justice. He didn't complain. He let him go. This would have lived in a shame culture that meant that this man, by rights, should have had his head held low. His son was leaving him, so thinking he was dead. He abandoned him. He then sold the property, double insult. He then went and lived in a foreign land, greater insult to the Jewish community, who was supposed to be a community, and then even more, he ends up working with pigs. Insult after insult. And the father's response when he sees him coming, runs at him. How come the father didn't say, "Get shut of him, bang him up in a penal colony, or throw away the key"? Because of relationship. The relationship was broken and he wanted to repair it. And so he welcomed him back. And actually, when all the other folks around were looking, he doubly embarrassed himself, you might say, because he hitched his skirts up and went charging down the road to welcome him. This is restorative justice. Let me just go back to those three things. You see in this passage radical participation, All the people are involved in what happens to the young man. The different parties who were hurt all come and discuss it. Do you notice that the oldest son, who is in that picture, there he is at the end, just coming into the scene, he's been out in the fields, presumably, and he comes back and he's appalled. He's so hurt that the father is holding a great meal, a banquet for his son. He refuses to come in. What's that about? It's about broken relationship. The son has had a broken relationship from his brother. Did you notice the language that he used? I need to read it. Luke 15. He answered the father, "All these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders. You never gave me even a goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours," not my brother, he's not a brother anymore, that relationship's dead in his eyes, "this son of yours who squandered your property with prostitutes comes home, you kill the fatted calf." And how does the father respond? "My son, you are always with me. Everything I have is yours. Remember, morally serious judgments. It's not forgive and forget. The son has squandered everything. He will get nothing from his father. The inheritance has gone. That's the serious judgment. But the relationship will be repaired." Actually, there's another serious judgment as well. They meet together and he has this party and his son has to come. Can you imagine being the son that's let your family down, being invited to a party where everything around, everyone around you, the whole community's there. They hate you because culturally you've done something appalling and you have to come and sit. Can you imagine what that must have been like? Serious judgment. But the relationships are repaired. And the father says to this older son, "You're always with me. Everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad because this brother of yours," he puts the relationship back in order. "He's alive. He was lost and he's found. He was dead and he's alive." And the ring is given to him and the relationship is restored and things are put back to normal. That's what God's heart is for us, showing justice to other people. So one last little bit of controversy for you, how we started the service. Who's this person? And do you recognize her? Her name is Shamima Begum. She is the young lady who, along with two school friends, left to become an ISIS bride. And then this year, tried to come back to this country. And do you remember the uproar as the government very clearly slammed the door shut? Not a chance. I wonder whether you were like me when you heard that on the news and thought to yourself, "What a cheek. How dare you? You come back after all you've done." I wonder if you, like me, struggled to find sympathy for someone who, let's face it, was not repentant. What does God's heart say? First of all, his heart is for restoration. You leave her out in Syria, what are you going to end up with? You're just going to end up with more hatred, more spreading of lies and who knows what. Her family, her mum and sisters, desperately wanted her back. They wanted the relationship healed. Interestingly, the father didn't. He wasn't in Britain at the time. I think he was in Bangladesh. And he said, no, she'd made her own bed, let her lie in it. He came from a pride culture. That was quite interesting that he should have that response. And the government said no. As it happened, she lost her third child anyway. What should our response have been? I believe the response should have been, embrace, to welcome her back, to have the strictest of judgments, which might have meant prison. That's not my department. I don't know how you would do that. But you can't ignore that. That has to be dealt with. But Ali believes all the parties concerned should hear and ultimately want that young woman to be restored to understand what civil society really is about. You want one more person who's not full of hatred and a relationship rebuilt. That's controversial. It's painful. It's really difficult. But that's what makes the difference between God's people being able to go down a road that's not comfortable. And I believe God calls us to be radically different, to see things from a different perspective. And I've probably just thrown a hand grenade out there that you might want to discuss as it explodes later. Because that's the point of this, that we think about it. We think about serious questions and think about where we might go in our solutions to them. Let's pray.